the size of the experiment has no bearing on the quality of the work. If we're using 20 pounds of lysine, and hell, I've got some non-essential amino acid stuff we've got going on. We've got urea in some diets. Man, an individual pig sort of deal is probably all that experiment needs at that time.
Swine it. It's time for a new era of communication in the swine industry, one that you can get the latest updates while commuting or driving to farms. Here, you will have the brightest minds of the global swine industry in your pocket.
Swine It Podcast is only possible with the support of forward-looking and innovative companies like Minitube, the worldwide leading supplier of systems for the field of assisted animal reproduction, Genesis, the first power in genetics, Merck Animal Health, driven by prevention, Evonik, we're sciencing the global food challenge, AB Vista, new nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production, Zinpro, essential trace minerals, exceptional performance. Every Pig, a simple yet powerful pig health and production management tool. Gestall, always one step ahead in swine feeding. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high quality, safe, and sustainable way. NutriQuest, experts serving producers and delivering breakthrough solutions.
Welcome to the Swine It Podcast Show. My name is Marcio Gonçalves, your host for today's episode.
This episode's sponsored highlight is about Merck Animal Health, used in more than 1 billion pigs worldwide. Circumvent G2 vaccines from Merck Animal Health provide the monumental protection swine herds need in the ever-evolving fight against circovirus. Circumvent PCV-G2 and Circumvent PCV-MG2 are evolutions of the original vaccine, modified to deliver the same efficacy in a convenient one- or two-dose option for increased flexibility. That's protection you can trust. Learn more at circumvent-g2.com.
Hello, everyone. Today we have Dr. Dustin Kendall, and super excited to chat with you, Dustin, and welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here. I was chatting with somebody earlier, you know, with Wayne Cass. He was, I believe, your very first one. So I was trying to get coached up from him today on what to expect. He gave me a few hints, so we'll see how it goes from here.
I love it. I'm sure he told you, hey, tell some stories. He's good at that. I love it. So cool. Dustin, if you can share for folks that don't know you and, you know, just your journey and where you are today and your education experience.
Yep. So I'm a Southern Indiana native, and then got my undergrad up at Purdue and then went back home and farmed for a few years. And then ended up going back up to Purdue for my master's with Brian Ricker and messed around with Schinkel just a little bit. Now I'm up there. And while I was there getting my master's, I did get the chance to go over to live in the Netherlands for about 6 months. It was some relationships with on the waste management side between Dr. Sutton and Martin Verstegen. So that was a good experience going over there for at least a short stint. And then once I got done with my master's, we moved out to the University of Missouri with Gary Ali and was out there for a few years, lived out at the sheep farm and helped try to round up some of our projects that we had ongoing there at some of the farm facilities. So I had some responsibility out there on a day-to-day stuff across a lot of the guys' projects, but got finished in 2004 down there. I should mention I've got married somewhere in there. So my wife Charmaine, and then we've got two boys. The oldest one, Wyatt, was actually born just before we moved out to Missouri. So some of the fellow grad students and such knew Wyatt when he was a little kid up to about 4 years old. And for those that knew me then or went to school then, realize he's a sophomore at NC State presently. So they're really freaking old. And then our youngest boy was born once we moved down here to North Carolina. So after I completed my PhD there, I guess in 2004, came down to North Carolina and went to work for Murphy Brown at that time. So Smithfield Foods, worked for Jeff Hansen for a good chunk of that. So there again's a reason for some folks to probably feel sorry for me a little bit, but that on balance, that was a good experience, both working for Jeff and working there at Murphy Brown. Nice. And it's getting close to 10 years. An opportunity came up here at Prestige Farm. So I shifted jobs and work here at Prestige Farms in a swine nutritionist role. We do have turkeys, but we leave that up to some consulting type folks. But at Prestige, we've got operations in Iowa, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and then South and North Carolina that I'd have responsibility for, all the formulation and to some extent feed performance. So interact a lot, obviously no different than any other production nutritionist with the production guys, with the feed milling guys, feed delivery, and every other jackleg that comes around. Our areas outside of Iowa are mostly all company owned mills. And then true to form in North Carolina, it's pretty much a contract grower relationship in terms of the grow finish growers. A funny thing about us, though, or at least Prestige Farms, is in Iowa, it's almost exclusively toll mills. Mm-hmm. But we own about 80-85% of our finishing spaces, so that the models are a little different, and it gives you a slightly different perspective on each of those. But anyway,
interesting.
That's about it. In our free time, we show livestock, mostly cattle, some sheep, and occasionally some pigs, either locally or state or even regional and national levels. We enjoy that a fair bit. The boys are getting old enough that the older ones starting to age out of some of those things, so that they're getting. I'm sad to admit how freaking gray my hair is, and it's getting to where I have to use stupid glasses to read stuff. So, at any rate, as much as a person would always like to think of themselves as still a young new nutritionist, it's starting to be the old part of the gray-haired bunch around here with all the younger guys floating around. But
I love it. That's cool. And that's when we get to pick your brain and other folks as well, pick some wisdom. So I love it. I want to know a little bit, when you went to Netherlands, any memories from like insights, like things that you learned culture wise or whatever, anything that you take, you still remember?
Well, these are some things if we had to do it over again, it would probably be things that we do differently. And then there's fairly stark cultural differences that, and it's probably a little bit my nature. But the first thing is we went over there, I believe it was about July 1st, and got over there and just rip-roaring ready to go. There ain't a damn soul in the Netherlands in July and August. everyone's on holiday. So it was difficult to get going when just a large fraction of either the faculty or the stat lab staff, whatever, hell, they just weren't there. That had we planned that a little bit better, I it would have been, I think, a better experience. And don't get me wrong, we had a great time. We learned a lot, but from some of our research things, that got a really slow start. The second piece of it, and I'll go back to whether it was at Purdue or at Missouri. My background is going to be exclusively in real applied research, and a bunch of it, and sometimes be on farm, and we're gonna try to overcome it with speed and volume. We're not going to get bogged down into doing a lot of lab work. So, you know, particularly when I was there at Missouri, we didn't let the damn Keldahl machine get in the way of running a pile of studies. In the Europe, my experience over there is they were going to be spending a lot more time worrying about just the detail. Man, I was wanting to operate in a much faster environment, and that just is a cultural thing. Anyway, we had a good time, learned a few things. I was telling, you know, at the end of that, you know, they were real gracious, and we had a super good time. I guess one of the funny things is we lived in a rented a room from a lady who was originally from California, but was a women's studies a professor at Wageningen. Let's just say someone from Southern Indiana, we're going to have some political views that are a little different from, and lifestyle views that are a little different than that, but that's also where you learn a little bit. But Dr. Verstegen, as we were leaving, you know, had a nice party for us, and he said, "Dustin, you're the most American I know." I'm not 100% sure that was a compliment.
I love it. Wow.
But it was a good time, and my wife and I both enjoyed it over there. And you know, it gives you certainly moving away like that, even though it's just a 6 month stint, you know, it gives you a different perspective on the world and your place in it, both good and bad. A couple of the things is you know, as an American, we unfortunately have a very centrist view of our own existence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some of the folks, it'd be just like lab folks or other grad students, they'd be talking about, man, how come the U.S. isn't doing this or this? And I had to finally just all but tell them, man, seriously, we don't even put any thought into the rest of the world when we're thinking about some of that stuff. That's not a good character trait. That's just the reality of it. So it's good seeing some of the other side of that.
Right.
Anyway, I'd flip it around to you as well, since the two of us don't know each other very well. You know, at least what little bit I know about your background coming from Brazil and then up to school there at K-State and then to PIC. What has kept you from going back to Brazil?
Right. No, I love it. And one comment you had there on the applied and versus the basic nature of research, right? And the details. And I think that goes a lot back to personality. My personality is also very much on the applied, right? Real life type of stuff. And that's why I got excited to go to K-State at the time, was because I remember seeing the studies on pen coverage, and I was like, wow, there are guys doing PhDs in feeder adjustment. I'm like, whoa, that's cool, because I was driving Brazil farms and different farms, and I was carrying some of those slides when it comes to, okay, how much feed we need in the feeder and that kind of stuff.
There you go.
But for me, I mean, on the US, I just love the efficiency of everything, you know. Things work, you know, in Brazil, oh boy, you know, we have lines and bureaucracy and boy, everything is low as well, you know, so yeah, that's interesting. And as everything else, like you said, there are pros and cons for everything.
We may be trying to improve the level of bureaucracy we got. We're going to increase that moving forward. I feel certain.
So you got that going forward. Yeah, it's a very fine line. I love it. And I remember when you and I were exchanging some emails, you mentioned about a quote here is, "A person needs to know a little about a lot of things." So I want to know your insights on that.
As I think through how the course of the day might go or a week around here, you know, I've got a, you know, occasionally you get tasked with either crop production questions or, you know, as it relates to maybe how markets are going. You know, we've got, with us having operations across multiple states, you've got to understand a little bit about the ingredient dynamics in all those different states. And the pricing relationships between ingredients is way different. You know, I need to have some, I mean, the things that I like about production ag are the fast paced, and it's not redundant. So we may be thinking through sow things, nursery, grow finish. We may get wrapped into our turkey business a little bit and questions we've got there. We've got, you know, research farms, both turkeys and pigs are doing those things. You got feed milling, feed delivery, you know, feed budgets, how that goes into it. And then just the interaction with the management. So at any moment, you've got to, you know, like I said, you got to know a little bit about a lot of things. That doesn't mean you're the, the expert by no means an expert in terms of like a PERS transmission, but you need to be able to intelligently talk about it. That's within the vet community, that sort of thing. But there's pieces you've got to be able to pull off a conversation. I would say that is useful for, whether it's vendors or whatever, just being able to talk intelligently about a wide variety of subjects. Occasionally when you have guys calling you as ingredient suppliers, it's so monotonous to oftentimes talk about their products. Hell, I'd just soon talk about other things. So, a little bit of that makes it where you're more useful in your job, but a little bit of it's being a bit more of a conversationalist and just being able to pick up on a lot of different subject areas and have a little bit of knowledge of each of them.
I love it. And I remember you also mentioned, about being humble, about learning new things and the difference between base knowledge and complete knowledge. And like I said, you don't have necessarily to be an expert in all of those.
Yeah. Things. And for the most part, it seems to me that the guys in the production nutritionist field, we've got to have a certain confidence to us. Now, outwardly, we've got to exude confidence, but the trick is you got to be able to be willing to listen to and entertain alternate thoughts, because hell, you may be wrong. But you still have to have a certain confidence and you try not to have an arrogance about it, but you do have to have confidence about the decisions that you've made, because you've got to defend those decisions to either your management team or your production group or whomever. And be able to walk through the reason that's a good decision for the business.
I love it. The other one I want to get your thoughts on is grad school. You know, when you came out of grad school, or what, if you're talking right now to a lot of faculty members, what would you tell them? Hey, your students need to learn more about this or that.
So I'd say that, and really wherever they'd go, I really enjoyed the fast-paced, dynamic world that we lived in there, Missouri, and also there at Purdue, where, you know, our interest in unashamedly, it was a production ag applied swine nutrition, and we tried to crush through a bunch of stuff, but it kept you sharp in terms of having multiple projects going on at a time, and to Dr. Ali's credit there, he got us engaged not only with some different vendors, but we did quite a bit of work with some different production companies. Sometimes it was work we do at their facilities. Sometimes it was, you know, so we would interact with Dean Boyd and the Hanor group, and we're trying to do some late finishing amino acid requirement studies. We actually defined the tryptophan to lysine requirement that you erroneously changed a few years later.
You like that?
that's neither here nor there. I can't help you wrong.
I love it. I love it.
Quite a bit of stuff up at Swine Graphics with Gene Gourley and in that group, and some with Wayne Cast. And at that time when he was at Smithfield Ball. So we interacted a lot with different production groups, some with vendors. You know, James Usry was quite a benefactor to Dr. Ali's program. He's a real good friend of mine and ours when he was there at Ajinomoto, and essentially funded a lot of our stuff. And I guess if one of the things that I enjoyed about and it's a little bit how Dr. Ali would kind of keep he'd have money in just sort of a pool. And I suspect the K-State crowd's kind of this way. They've got projects coming in all the time. They've got money coming in. You know, they've made an honest effort of budgeting those things, but there's, you occasionally have go in some different directions. But one of the good examples that I always reference is we'd set out on some of that amino acid stuff with really just a grand desire. James challenged us, and at that time it was me and Aaron Gaines and Jason Frank and Russell Fent and Brent Ratliff were all there. But one of the things that he challenged us with was trying to get up to 20 pounds of L-lysine use in diets, just as a grand objective. And then they'd sort of let us as grad students figure out what those next steps were, whether it was little incremental steps or whether it was trying to go for bigger pieces of it, and gave us a lot of leeway to essentially make our own program that way. You weren't caught up in trying to budget the next experiment. It was just a pool of dollars and we'd go get it. I flip around on the backside of it. And I think the benefit that James and the guys at Ajinomoto might have we might be doing a study where we've got 18 or 20 pounds of L-lysine in the diet, and it honestly didn't at that level. I mean, it didn't work. But at that time frame, the industry was still stuck on, you'd never dare get above about 6. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But by us trying to get to 18 or 20, we could move that deal up to 8 or 10 or give folks some comfort level up in there. Those were great. Even though we wouldn't personally think it was a failure, it was a useful piece of data or experiment for him to take out to other production companies or ingredient manufacturers or feed companies and kind of talk about the merits of probably spinning that into what you could start flipping that around of what should we do next and kind of bait them into even though we weren't necessarily going to listen to them because we were making our own, but he was funding us not exactly to get the exact answer, but to drive
innovation, right? And push the limits.
So that as a program and as a big target was that was valuable for us. And like I said, I think it was in the end, it was useful to Ajinomoto and they had great information to share with customers because part of that if I see this when we have folks want to come visit with me, man, if they don't have something that's just half-ass interesting, it's just brutal having people just drone on and on about stuff we've already talked about it makes the conversation a lot more interesting if you have some novel bits of information or some thoughts that are a little counter to what you think, and then you can kind of debate it here. But anyway,
I love it. Well, on that topic, you know, and now say, if you're talking to vendors in general, like, what is your recommendation when it comes to, hey, this is what I want to see from when it comes to research, I mean, sample size.
Yeah.
Right, to not waste your time as a production nutrition.
This is that whole knowing a little bit about a lot of things. So I've spent a fair, and I'll even come back to our experience at Missouri. So the size of the experiment has no bearing on the quality of the work. Different things require different, I'll use this example. If we're using 20 pounds of lysine and hell, I've got some non-essential amino acid stuff we've got going on. We've got urea in some diets. Man, an individual pig sort of deal is probably all that experiment needs at that time. Now, the next increment, once you get a lead on, is you build that into maybe, like your small pen nursery stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, once you build on that, those experiments have a certain progression. They should not all start with a 1200 head commercial facility. It's a damn waste of money for folks. Folks feel obligated to do that. There are plenty of experiments that need some parsing in a different setup. Maybe that's a digestibility trial. I mean, there's certain usefulness to a digestibility trial. It's nice to then couple that with, if you, for example, an enzyme, say it would be quite appropriate to do a digestibility trial. You see a 5% improvement in digestibility. Now you just quite easily, you gotta back that up with something at a larger scale and a more production. And if those two things square up, man, you got something. But if you just bring the one, mm-hmm. It's not so good. And if you just bring the other, it's not so good. And so I'm really hesitant to ever give too much advice on size of experiments. Mm-hmm. We would have, this will. So while I'm there, Smithfield or Murphy Brown, you know, we'd occasionally have, we'd be trying to do field experiments. So, I mean, you're going to be in some cases millions of animals. Well, that makes it no more important than something that's in a research nursery or something like that. Everything has their place.
Yeah.
So that's my only advice to guys. Sometimes want to force experiments into places they shouldn't. A couple other pieces associated with that is many vendors don't spend enough time thinking through like a dose titration. And I'll use this example. They've maybe, their production guys say, all right, 100 units of this is going to cost about $1. Okay. Well, folks are immediately under the assumption, well, hell, there's no way they're going to spend over $1. So we're just going to have to put 100 units in. Whereas if they put 300 units in, maybe it'd give a substantial improvement or noticeable improvement. But they'll get caught in trying to think through what the hell my head's going through in terms of it's so hard to feel comfortable that something is offering value. You just need to set the economics off to the side for a little while, feel more comfortable in whether the response is there, and then we'll worry about cheaping it up or cheating it or doing other things. Or maybe it just stands on its own value. So sometimes I worry that, and hell, we're to blame. Folks in my position are all the time beating people up about price. That's just because it's fun. I'd be a lot more happy if the shit had worked, and you'd have a lot more intelligent discussion. And at any rate, that's what I got to say about that. That sounds like
I love it. I love it. That's
Forrest Gump.
No, that's very, very helpful. maybe to dive a little on that still is, you know, today, because we didn't find the next ractopamine, some of this stuff, some of the additives will work only a percentage of the time, right? So then how do you wrap your head around that?
As a trial, we'll think about some of the growth promoting antibiotics, for example, and let's just use that as an example. Hell, they don't work 100% of the time, but if you do several studies, you're going to see a response there. Yeah, they may, you know, you've got a couple that are closer to a push in terms of a feed to conversion response. Some of them that may be 5-6 points, but on balance, you kind of come up with a number. They're not working all the time, but in some of those cases, if I feel comfortable, it is because I've got to feel comfortable. It's returning something. I am tasked with reducing our cost per hundredweight. Mm-hmm. If that reduces it by a penny in a cost per hundredweight, well, that's what I ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. Folks will get awful hung up on ROI, and maybe that helps take up the slack of not seeing a response all the time. But if it's a 1.1 to 1 ROI, hell, you ought to be doing it. I'm not looking to encourage lots of quack sales guys to come by with really narrow returns, because I think some of that where folks will think about a 3-to-1, yeah, sort of, but all that does is maybe takes up some of the slack of the variance that you see ultimately in the system. I know this about our production world. And there was a gentleman, and it was forever. It was probably 4 or 5 years ago. He was in here. It was the sales guy brought in the president of some company, and he was in here. And boy, he was just knocking it out one at a time. I got this product. It does this. He got about 8 products into the deal. I told him to stop. I said, you want to know how we can be successful in our company. And I mean, he jumped up. He thought, man, this is really going to be insightful. And this is in the concept of our production. Well, I said, one, make sure the son of a bitch has water every day. And sometimes that we will run into issues with that. Make sure they got feet. Make sure the ventilation's halfway right. Hopefully on a health status, it's not too terrible, but how we get away with lots of different things. Hopefully you have a semi-competent nutritionist. You don't even have to have a good one. And a hog industry or a hog production company can be successful if you get about those 5 things kind of close. So many of those products are so far down the list. They may add a little bit of value, and we'll use some of them, but they're not really what drives our business. They're little rounding errors that may help you a little bit. At any rate, so.
Yeah, yeah. No, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the priorities. Something I like to talk about is the priorities of the production nutritionist. Yep. And you mentioned already, right? The feed, the water, the feed. What else, right? It could be feed implementation.
Well, feed budgets is so feed budgets are kind of they've got a few different rationales why you do it. It certainly depends on the first thing is, and I'll think of kind of a nursery or a wean to finish or early wean to finish. You know, what's your bin configuration? So we've got some spots like our wean to finish barns are typically a tandem bin. So we can feed whatever we want of that first and second diet in terms of volume, because we can get that delivered and it's not that big a deal. In some of our more straight up nursery settings, that's a single bin setup. Now it becomes real important in many of our, so our organization as a whole, we're kind of pelleting guys. And that's not to discount folks that feed mash feeds, but that's in our nature. It's in our DNA. We're going to tend to try to consolidate those, make the run times as long as we can. Mm-hmm. So we consolidate up when we make stuff. So nursery feeds typically get made on one day a week. So your feed budget becomes a bit more of what, how long does it take to get to a week worth of consumption, because the second diet's coming in a week, a week or 2 weeks. It could be that wide. So your feed budget somewhat gets driven by the pig consumption and how you plan on delivering feed. It's kind of an illustration of that is our one of our systems down in Oklahoma. We had we just put them on when we bought them in 2011. They just went on a kind of a normal budget like we might have in some other locations where those pigs had like a 5-pound budget on the first diet, and we'd colored that feed red, and then they went on what other feed types. We're down there touring and we hadn't owned that very long, but we kept noticing on all the old pigs all this red feed coming through. All it was is that 5 pounds was way too much feed for those pigs to eat in a 7-day period. And we were delivering the second and then the third and fourth and all the rest of the deliveries. And that red feed just always sat there in the bottom of the bin. Mm-hmm. So we had a 5-pound budget. Pigs were only eating 3 pounds of it. And the other two would come out at the end of the turn when we're trying to empty the bin. So just from a feed budget or even feed savings, we just lowered the budget to 3 pounds. The pigs got exactly the same amount of feed at that time frame. We just quit feeding the 50-pound pigs our first nursery diet is all it was. So you run into lots of those sort of things that they're important for our cost and how we run our business. And it's not a gadgety sort of thing. Those are just the blocking and tackling things that we deal with.
I love it. Is there something that you disagree with most nutritionists or more than 50% of the nutritionists? I always like to ask that question because it brings back to what you said early on the different cultures, Netherlands, whatever. That's where progress is made, right? So that's why I want to ask that question.
So I'm going to say yes. Hell, there's probably lots of things I disagree with different folks, but one of them that comes to mind is, and think of it like this: we've got pigs in lots of different geographies. Okay, the dynamics of ingredient pricing are way different places, and right now it's a little bit different, but generally speaking, if we think about the cost of added fat. In Iowa, it's typically pretty high and corn's pretty low. Okay, so that fat corn relationship's pretty squirrely. In North Carolina, our corn's really expensive and sometimes the fat's fairly affordable. So, I'll run pretty different or spent lots of time having pretty different energy levels, between North Carolina or Iowa operation or Oklahoma. Our company have a history of having that, the energy levels being much more flat. So as I started doing some of those things, that caused an awful lot of friction within our accounting group about why the hell is the feed conversion so bad in Iowa? And then might simultaneously say, but man, they got a good feed cost. Well, those two things, are interrelated in many cases. So anyway, having not an energy requirement, but let energy float up and down. Yeah, I've got everything else related to it, but it's really if you think about just a straight corn soy diet, it's got whatever energy value you want. And then I'm just looking for other options that might be more cost favorable, such as added fat. And if fat's at a really good relationship to corn, man, I'm gonna jack that up. One of the things that I always tell folks is my max fat is mostly dictated by the diameter of the pipe that goes to the downstream application. And what I mean by that is 8% about all I can put on here. Mm-hmm. Guess what? We'll go to 8. It should either be down at your minimum or it should be at close to that maximum. Right. Being in between there is like being half pregnant. and I guess it's a safe spot to be, but I don't think it's right. If fat's too costly versus corn, it ought not be in there. If it's a good value, you ought to be entertaining, you know, what's the maximum. The only times I'll be in between is really on availability. Okay. You can't get enough, or you know, sometimes, well, like in our Oklahoma operation, we kind of had to, tends to be kind of a tallow based deal. This time of year, it turns into a solid brick bat in the bins. So you've got some flowability problems you need to be cognizant of and dial those things back. But the other thing is whether it's late finishing or early finishing, or I have pretty differential values on the value of fat, and we'll let that energy float up and down, because you've got to have a way of stepping back so I can increment by, you know, the cheaper that fat gets, I'm going to add it into more diets at a higher rate. If it gets more expensive, I've got to have a way of backing out of some of that without, I think it's stupid to drop them all. But the back end and the front end have considerably different values in my view.
So I don't know if I missed here, but because I was making some notes, but did you early versus late, which one do you see more response?
Late. And I think there's a couple different reasons for that. One of which is, it's probably a little bit of just the straight efficiency of that pig out late. You know, he's wanting to deposit a fair amount of fat. He's probably just shunting some of that dietary lipid, more or less, right? You don't have to, it doesn't have to go in lots of different directions. He's just going to deposit some of that straight on. The other bit's just a freaking math problem. You know, if you've, you know, in all my experience of doing just, we do a lot of fat titrations, and over the years in North Carolina, that's just something you do a lot of. And that is almost like your pain coverage thing. I mean, people look at me like I got a third head when I say I'm doing a fat titration, but it's really important to us to try to capture that and understand it. But that, you know, we'll see the feed intake respond, you know, just like you'd expect. The higher the energy of that diet, pigs are just going to eat less. You know, if you're at something where you've got, and we'll tend to see growth rate pretty neutral. Okay. If anything, it pretty neutral. If I've got a 0% added fat, I'll normally see a response to something. The rest of it's flat-ish.
Okay.
But you do see the jump from like a zero to something. I don't know whether that's a flavoring, a dust, or what exactly. Mm-hmm. But the growth rate's mostly pretty flat.
Okay.
Beyond that, then it's just that, you know, if they're going to drop, if you've got a bunch of fat in there and they drop their feed intake 10%, and you get a similar growth rate. It's better when it's on a 3-0 conversion than like a 50-pound pig that's a 1-6 feed conversion. It's just a math problem then. So it comes closer to being worth twice as much or thereabouts out late, because we tend to think of it all in terms of just points of feed conversion.
Right, right. Yes, I see, as a percentage. That's good. What's the ratio, your fat price to corn price ratio? What's that break point for you?
You know, early on, or like early finishing and you know, it gets down towards that 2.25, maybe 2.5 ratio. Out late, honestly, some of the coefficients I've got in there, that'll get closer to 4. But anyway, those continue to be pieces that are evolving in my head and data we do. It seems so idiotic, probably to lots of the viewers of when I describe, I basically perpetually have been doing amino acid titrations mm-hmm. and energy titrations. It's so important to our business, those two pieces, trying to have them right and have a philosophy that's right. Mm-hmm. It takes away from, doing yeast research, but Jesus Christ, there's plenty of folks doing stuff like that. We'll get around to that. It's just more important to me that we have some of those other pieces and continue to try to learn from. I've been kind of reassessing some of my coefficients there on an energy response and where I'm at now out there very late. It's higher than probably what a lot of people will be. What's yours? You're a fancy PIC, former PIC guy.
Rule of thumb, right? 3.5. Yeah, 3.5 to 4, rule of thumb. But I never thought about the early versus late different ratios there. So I like that. The other thing is, when you say, that you spend a lot of time looking at energy, amino acid, well, that's music to my ears, because I always like to say to think, hey, what is the 20% of your actions that's going to drive 80% of the result? And very often people reply, energy and amino acids. So
yeah,
I love it. Let's see here. I had a quote here from our exchange via email that said the laws of unintended consequences are alive and well within a production system. So I'm curious on your thoughts there.
It's outside my direct purview, but just as you're a student of swine production or swine production systems, it's not always things that directly, they impact the business, but you sort of see them and when you see them, you try to, bring up questions, but I'll use a one example and then you can spin off there. But when if we have a policy where we have our sow farms being centered on pre-wean mortality, okay, that'll change pre-wean mortality. Now, we didn't wean a damn more pig, but our stillborns went up or total born dropped. So we have dozens of pieces like that in our business that don't necessarily improve us, but we've got to continue to strive to make sure the incentives are in alignment with the goals of the production system. And, you use our own operation as a, I guess a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, we fired up our packing plant there in Iowa. Well, that's a big shift to our business. And that's evolving how we, become more integrated. All of our production system down here in the Carolinas and in Oklahoma, we're selling those pigs to someone else. And it's a different deal when it's your own packing plant. Mm-hmm. But pieces as simple as, what do you have a matrix or what should that matrix look like in terms of sort discount, or down here in North Carolina, that's a big focus. Cause those are dollars that would be otherwise discounted. We've, at least kind of went down that route as well in our Iowa operations, but ultimately is that the right business decision or we've got to have those two pieces in alignment as well. So, you know, I think any organization has to continue to look and see, you know, the way they incent their people or incent their business, does that make sense with what the overall objectives are?
I love it. I love it. Yeah, the world revolves around the incentives, and yep. I love it. Very good. Any final thoughts here, Dustin, before we jump into the last few questions I have every episode here? Any final insights?
No, I don't think so.
Cool.
It is time to our famous three.
A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, our company offers specialized technical support for nutritionists, veterinarians, and other animal production professionals. Our portfolio of programs and services include a wide array of high-performing feed solutions such as essential nutrients, palatability, feed preservation, mycotoxin management, and health and nutrition. To learn more about our company, visit us at www.adiseo.com. For knowledge and news from the global swine industry, access our partner, thepigsite.com.
So the first one here is any resource. I mean, I remember sitting on a class from Dr. Goodband back in grad school, and in first class he say, hey, one of the most important things you have is your phone, right? So just being resourceful. You know, what are the greatest resource for you as a nutritionist?
I don't do just gobs of reading just for the sake of reading. I mean, obviously some of our textbooks and those sort of things will be resources, but I'm going to end up using colleagues in the industry, other, you know, whether that's folks that work for ingredient companies or just friends across the industry to bounce ideas off and try to shape my thinking. You know, it's always probably a little more useful to ask folks that aren't directly tied to something just to see if they have, you know, for example, if you wanted to call somebody or if you were curious about people's experience with Bacillus products, it probably doesn't make much sense to call somebody that sells Bacillus products because odds are good they're going to be pretty big fans.
Right.
But you reach out to a different subset of folks, and I'm going to use that telephone to do a lot of that heavy lifting and you know, learn from other people's Wayne Cass says, you know, learn from other people's mistakes.
Yes.
As much as anything.
I love it.
That's my nature on most things is and also probably a fair amount of reflection on and trying to really think through any negatives. You know, and that's also those unintended consequences, you know, and we think about, and not that I'm any sort of expert on it, but, you know, some of the things that we've learned in terms of some of the branch chain interactions with as it relates to DDG and some different things. Well, we didn't go into that in, you know, trying to look for those interactions. They were just sort of, they came upon us. But you don't want to take some sort of dramatic action there because you need to at least take time to consider the consequences of, you know, if you didn't like, and maybe all of a sudden you drop, change your ingredient flow a huge amount, which has implications on diet costs. You need to be careful that one, you're right, and two, you know, is there more reasonable tactics to take there? So say a fair bit of reflection is also useful before you make a big decision.
I love it. Very cool. And then the last one is, in your opinion, what sets apart successful swine professionals from those that are not?
I mean, we talked about some of the things in terms of having a breadth of some knowledge in lots of areas, and boy, that's useful, not only in being able to carry on a conversation with people, but you also learn you know, things that maybe in you know, I'll dabble around a little bit with cattle feed in our own stuff, and there's little bits that you learn there that are useful. So being open to new ideas, but yet still having a conviction and working through, like on our discussion there on some of the fat things. Mm-hmm. Having a well thought out plan that still you're willing to morph it a little bit, but it's not taken away from that overall philosophy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether it's new kids coming out, you know, you've got to develop your own philosophy. But that philosophy you may need to you may be proven wrong, and you don't always have to admit it. You just have to adopt the more correct version. And those folks that are really clever, they'll adopt that new and improved version and call it their own.
I love it. Well, Dustin, it's been a great chat here. Lots of new insights for our audience, no doubt. So I really appreciate our time. I don't think I've seen, you know, I know you're very, what's the best word?
I'm a recluse, kind of a curmudgeon, as it were. And you know, it's getting to be a damn rare species, a swine nutritionist in North Carolina. So. You know, there's just a couple of us left down here now. So, you know, it's about like those spotted leopards up in the Himalayas. So, anyway.
Yeah, I love it. So, I appreciate our time for the podcast today. Thank you.
All right, it's been a pleasure.
Imagine if with a few key concepts, you could have the potential to create a massive positive impact by bringing from hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars for swine producers. Join this small group and go to the next level of swine nutrition on this 7-week long elite online training in applied swine nutrition and feeding. It's conducted by myself, Dr. Marcio Gonçalves, and my world-class invited speakers. Additionally, you enjoy an exclusive community to exchange ideas. Go now to www.eliteswinenutritionist.com.